Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Peter Hart and with me in my snuggledy home is lovely Gary Bain. Hiya, Gary.
Hi, Pete. How are you?
I'm well. What are we doing today?
Well, today, Pete, we're going to be looking at the defence of Rorke's Drift of the 22nd to the 23rd of January 1879.
That's because listeners, I write 1878 in the notes, didn't I, Gary?
But you did.
A higher power saved me from embarrassment. Who was that higher power?
That'd be me.
It was you. Or Fred.
Or Fred, yeah.
He could have sent it telepathically.
Now, what was Rorke's Drift?
I don't know.
Well, it was the former trading post of a merchant called James Rorke.
I was guessing Rorke.
And it was positioned near a drift.
What's
or
a drift?
A ford. On the Buffalo River border.
That's called something else now, but we're sticking to the names from then, aren't we?
Cause we are.
It's easy.
And it's between the then British colony of Natal and the Zulu territory ruled by King Cetshwayo.
Ooh, have you been practising that name?
I've been practising that. And by 1879, it was a Church of Sweden mission station run by an Otto Witt or Witt. I don't know how you would say that.
No, Swedish. I don't know. No. Now, we did the background. This is all part of, it's part of the background to the Battle of Isandlwana, which we've never learned how to pronounce, and we just glide past it, hoping the listeners don't notice. One of the many things we hope you don't notice. Yes. And we'd like to say before we go on that we're not experts on this period. Neither of us. We like reading about it. We bought lots of books about it, some of which we've read and some we haven't. But in no way are we experts. We're just people who have an interest in this period. That would sum it up, wouldn't it, Gary?
Yeah, that's fair.
Or have you no interest in this period?
No, that's fair. And we should point out, as with the Isandlwana podcast, for the quotes, we do use the terminology of the day, some of which can be quite offensive to the modern ear.
Yeah, we've taken a couple of unnecessary ones which don't change the context of the quote out, but there's still a couple left because we're not going to change things, we'll only omit them. Right, so what's the background? Well, it's the background of Isandlwana, as I said. And on the 9th of January 1879, the British number 3, that's the centre column of a sort of multiple attack launched by Lord Chelmsford. They arrived and camped around the drift, didn't they? They didn't stay long, did they?
No, on the 11th of January, the day after the British ultimatum to the Zulus expired.
Was that ultimatum a fair and cuddly thing, or was it sort of naked imperialism and aggression by the British?
Well, ultimatums very rarely are fair and cuddly things, are they? Yeah. That's why they're called ultimatums.
Is a clue in the word.
Yeah. Now, that had expired, and the column crossed the river and then encamped on the Zulu bank.
It's as if they were engaging in an act of war.
Mm. Now, a small force consisting of B Company, 2nd Battalion, 24th, 2nd Warwickshire Regiment of Foot, which we'll now call the 2nd 24th, just for ease. It was detailed to garrison the post.
So that's just one company?
Yeah, and the post had been made into a supply depot and hospital. And they were under the command of a Lieutenant Gonville Bromhead.
Ooh,
who's remember that name because it's going to be quite important later on.
He sounds a bit posh. Now, on the 19th of January, a small detachment of Number 5 Field Company Royal Engineers arrived. And they're commanded by who? He's the other key figure in the story, isn't he? Who's commanding them?
Lieutenant John Chard, Royal Engineers. And he had arrived to repair the pontoon bridge over the Buffalo River.
Now, now the next bit we have covered in the podcast, which was, I think, broadcast on the anniversary last year.
It was.
In fact, we promised to follow up with Rorke's Drift within a matter of weeks.
And we have.
And we have.
52 weeks.
And on the 20th of January, Chelmsford's column march off to the Isandlwana Rock feature, which is approximately 6 miles to the east. It's not far. Sometimes I fail to realise, but it is out of sight, out of sight. And they leave behind this small garrison. And then more people who feature in the other podcast arrive, because that evening the number 2 column arrives, and that's under Colonel Anthony Durnford. Another key figure in the Battle of Isandlwana, who arrive, they arrive and camp on the Zulu bank, and they remain there for the next day. So that's 20th, 21st. But they don't stay either, do they?
No, late on that evening, the 21st January, Durnford's number 2 column was ordered to Isandlwana, as was Chard's number 5 field company.
Now, he rides ahead, doesn't he? So essentially, just he rides forward. And what happens to him?
Well, he does.
When does he go? Let's get this straight for people. It's the morning of the 22nd, isn't it?
Yeah, he rides ahead. And on the morning of the 22nd of January, he's gone to clarify his orders. But when he gets to Rorke's Drift, he's sent back. He was sent back from Isandlwana to Rorke's Drift because he was ordered to construct the defensive positions.
Just in case.
Yeah.
Because there are, by that time, they're realising there's quite a few Zulus about. But it's key to note, the Isandlwana battle hadn't started then, had it?
No, but...
There's something crucial here. What happens here? Because they're not in command. Neither Chard nor Bromhead are in command, are they? At that point, who's in command?
Well, when he gets back, Chard sort of mentions that he'd seen large numbers of Zulus about. And so the officer in command is a Brevet Major Henry Spalding.
Now, he's a staff officer, isn't he?
He's
not one of the 2nd, 24th, and he's not an engineer, but he's a staff officer that's been left behind, yeah?
Now, he realises that he's, in effect, because of his Brevet rank, which is like a local rank, it's a higher rank in the wider army.
So he's a
army.
Captain, really.
Yeah, so it's a higher rank in the wider army than it might be in his corps or regiment. And he realises that he's going to be the senior officer. And he decides, quite rightly, I think, that he needs to get off and find the reinforcements that they're expecting to come from Helpmekar, which is about 15 miles away, where they're expecting one column. And he thinks, because of the number of Zulus that have been mentioned, they're going to need two.
And they need to get a bloody move on.
And they need to get a shift on.
And why is his rank important to that?
Well, because...
He outranks the officer at How did you say that, guy?
Helpmekar.
That's blippy. How do you do this? And then mispronounce Natal. Sorry, I just want to throw that in.
I might have been talking about Nutella.
You might. You do like a spot on Nutella.
I do.
But anyway, now this is he doesn't feature in our story again, really, because but he's back. There's some muck smeared at him, flung at him, isn't it?
And we think wrongly,
don't we?
Yeah, because it looks like, you know, before he left, he checks the army list to see who's actually senior out of Lieutenants Chard and Bromhead, and then disappears. And there is the suggestion that he's sort of run away.
And that's not the case.
He's doing the sensible thing. He is getting reinforcements, given the few... amount of defenders that are at Rorke's Drift.
And he does actually try and bring those two companies forward with him, but on the way he's met by people who tell him that Rorke's Drift's fallen. So he then goes back to construct the defence to defend Helpmekar. So in our view, Spalding does no wrong. He's just a bit unfortunate the way things look.
No, and as a result, Chard's left in temporary command of the forces at Rorke's Drift. Now...
Because he's senior to Bromhead.
He is, yeah. Now, he rides down to the ford where the engineers' camp's located. And here, he meets two survivors from Isandlwana who arrive with news of the catastrophic defeat and warning that a Zulu impi was actually fast approaching the Rorke's Drift. And you're going to be Lieutenant John Chard of No. 5 Field Company Royal Engineers.
My attention was... call to two horsemen galloping towards us from the direction of Isandlwana. He couldn't pronounce it either. From their gesticulation and their shouts, when they were near enough to be heard, we saw that something was the matter. On taking them over the river, one of them, Lieutenant Adendorf of Lonsdale's regiment, native Natal native contingent, was asking if I was an officer. Jumping off his horse, he took me to one side and told me that the camp was in the hands of the Zulus and the army destroyed, that scarcely a man had got away to tell the tale, and that probably Lord Chelmsford and the rest of the column had shared the same fate. His companion, a carbineer, confirmed his story. He was naturally very excited, and I'm afraid I did not at first quite believe him, and intimated that he probably had not remained to see what did occur. So he's flinging mud as well. This is quite common in all armies, you know. They have a meeting. Now, there's two... Funny enough, Chard wasn't originally that bothered by the tip, but he had become bothered. But they have a meeting, don't they? So Chard, Bromhead, and acting assistant commissary James Dalton, commissariat and transport. Is that the army transport department? Is that the army service corps as would be?
As would become, yeah.
They have a meeting, and the key figure here is probably Dalton. In one sense, and Chard and Bromhead in the other. They decide. They have to decide whether to retreat themselves to help Makar, don't they? Or to hold Rourke's drift. Now, what's in their minds?
Well, Dalton actually points out, and again...
He's an experienced old soldier.
He's an old soldier, and he points out, and we covered this off in the podcast about Isandlwana, that a small column with carts full of the 36 hospital patients would be overtaken and massacred in the open by the numerically overwhelming Zulus. And therefore... it was agreed to stand and fight at Rourke's Drift.
So it's sort of, they wouldn't want to start from here, but having started from there, they haven't really got any option.
No, because of how slowly they would be moving in those carts.
Well, those carts would be going at 0 miles an hour, essentially, wouldn't they? Hmm. Chard and Bromhead direct the defensive preparations. But again, Dalton is his experience is absolutely vital. But I'm always interested in Chard Bromhead. I had the view, and possibly influenced by a certain film, which we're not really going to mention much, that these were thrusting young officers, if you like. But they're not young officers, are they?
They're both in their 30s. And Bromhead, he was actually seriously deaf.
Pardon?
He was seriously deaf.
Not picking you up here too.
Now, that's a bit of a comment on an army where promotion was based on seniority.
Yeah, that they could be considered young, because they're not young, but certainly most times in the British Army, they'd be passed over almost for promotion. As we said, the practicalities of the defence, they're sort of sketched out by the Char and Bromhead, but James Dalton, he's the one who's done a field fortification course. That was lucky, wasn't it? And he sets it up. So what does he set up?
Well, he puts a defensive perimeter which incorporates the main buildings of the storehouse and the hospital and has that constructed. A 4 foot or even higher wall was made out of 200-pound mealy bags and 100-weight biscuit boxes. Now, I want to make a point here. They were quite lucky in the sense of the stores that they had, because both the mealy bags and the biscuit boxes would prove to be ideal for... building fortifications and defences. The mealy bags were like sandbags.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to give us an idea of this, we've got a quote from Private Henry Hook, 2nd 24th, and you're going to give us this.
The mealy bags were good, big, heavy things, weighing about 200 pounds each. And during the fight, many of them were burst open by assegais and bullets. And the mealies, which is Indian corn, were thickly spread about the ground. The biscuit boxes contained ordinary biscuit. They were big, square, wooden boxes, weighing about 100 weight each. The meat boxes, too, were very heavy, as they contained tinned meat. They were smaller than the biscuit boxes.
Yeah, so you couldn't push them over. That's the key thing. These are solid. And there's also something else helping. They've got a couple of wagons that they use to fill the 120-foot gap between the storehouse and the hospital, because this is... they've got a lot to cover with, you know. But what do they do to the buildings?
Well, they convert the buildings into sort of mini forts.
How?
Well, they construct loopholes, which they bash through the outer walls. And the doors, they barricaded with furniture. Now, the tents, they were collapsed. which is something that didn't happen at Isla Nuana, I seem to remember,
yeah.
And left strewn on the ground as a mild embuggerance to movement for the attackers.
Yeah, well, that would. It's just they're just strewn about the place.
Now, whilst they are working, there were some unwelcome distractions, and you're going to explain by being Lieutenant John Chard again.
Several fugitives from the camp, that's Isla Nuana, arrived and tried to impress upon us the madness of an attempt to defend the place. Who they were, I do not know, but it is scarcely necessary for me to say that there were no officers of Her Majesty's army among them. They stopped the work very much, it being impossible to prevent the men getting round them in little groups to hear their story. They proved the truth of their belief in what they said by leaving us to our fate. And in the state of mind they were in, I think our little garrison was as well without them. In other words, adding panicking men to a already panicked men to the garrison wasn't helping. In fact, they were a bloody nuisance from start to finish. Now, yeah. Somebody else arrived. When did they arrive? Who comes?
Well, around 15:30, 3:30 in the afternoon.
Now, we want to make a point about this, that the times are dodgy. There's problems with wristwatches of the time anyway. But also, this is an incredible period. And throughout, our timings are approximate. And no books agree.
No, and particularly when, you know, times when action has started, it's unreliable. But it's around 3:30 in the afternoon, about 100 Natal native horse arrive under Lieutenant Alfred Henderson. And having retreated in fairly good order from the debacle at Isla Nuana.
Yeah, they hadn't been caught in the wings. They got away. And what does Chard order them to do? Or what do I, as Chard, order them to do?
They were ordered to provide a series of vedettes stretching around Rorke's Drift. Yeah, with a picket up on the far side of the Oscarberg.
The Oscarberg?
Well, that was a large hill that overlooked the station in the it was in the overall direction from which the Zulus were expected to approach.
And this is quite close, isn't it? So the drift sort of nestles underneath it. So
your defenders of Rorke's Drift...
Are we going to sum this up?
They're going to consist of...
Right.
Lieutenant Bromhead's B Company of the 2nd 24th.
Lieutenant George Stevenson's...
George Stevenson.
Thank you. Company of the Natal Native Contingent. That's about 100 men in that.
Lieutenant Henderson's Natal Native Horse Troop.
They're the ones we just mentioned. Various hospital patients and walking wounded. I don't know quite how many there were, but we mentioned a figure of 36 earlier. I don't know, but there's a few of them. Some of them are walking wounded, though. It's worth remembering that.
Yeah, so Chard posted the British soldiers around the perimeter.
That's the mealy bag perimeter and the rest of it, yeah.
Adding some of the more able patients,
yeah,
the casuals and civilians, and those of the NNC,
Natal Native Contingent,
who possessed firearms along the barricade. Now,
what could be fatal to their hopes of survival, do you think?
Well, as is often the case, rum.
You mean the British Army, the British soldier can't be trusted with alcohol?
Well, something like that. And Lieutenant John Chard goes on to say...
There were several casks of rum in the store building, and I gave strict orders to Sergeant Windridge, 24th Regiment, who was in charge, acting as issuer of commissariat stores to the troops, that the spirit was not to be touched. The man posted nearest it was to be considered on guard over it, and after giving fair warning, was to shoot without altercation anyone who attempted to force his post. And Sergeant Windridge being there to see that this was carried out. Oh, they're going to shoot them if they try and get the rum.
Yeah.
You'd have still gone for it.
Now, water was issued, and each man had full pouches and extra ammunition ready at their side.
Yeah, because they're just single-shot rifles, so you need to have the rifle nearby to make it as quick as possible, the reloading process. Lots of rounds close at hand.
Now, the rest of the NNC...
What are they armed with?
They're armed mostly with spears, but... They also had a few old muskets, and they were posted within the kraal.
What's a kraal?
Well, that's in this case, it's an enclosure for sheep or cattle.
And that's just attached to the thing, but it's not part of the main defences.
It's not part of the main defence, no.
But it is part of the defences, and they've put... They sound as if they're a bit of an afterthought.
Yeah, it did have a low stone wall, so it did provide some cover, but it obviously was not as as good as being within the main defences. Now, Sergeant Major James Reynolds, he was the temporary chaplain.
He was the Sergeant Major.
Sergeant Major James Collins, the temporary chaplain, Reverend George Smith.
Ah, the perils of commas.
The previously mentioned pastor, Otto Witt, or Witt, rode up the 500-foot-high Oscarburg Hill to see what they could see. And they returned at about 1600 on the 22nd of January with the grim news that a large body of Zulus was fording the Buffalo to the southeast, and it was no more than 5 minutes away.
God, blimey, this must have been a bit brown trousery time. It's unbelievable to think of it, really. Who are these? Who is approaching them? We're not going to go into details. Let's just give an outline.
Well, I'd also say that it was at this point that Otto Witt left Rorke's Drift, and that was to be with his family, who lived in an isolated farmhouse which was about 19 miles away.
So this isn't the story, again, from that film?
No, unlike the film. Yeah. And he did have a daughter, but she was about seven, not a sort of...
Strapping young lass,
no. Now, you mentioned the approaching Zulu force.
Who are they?
It's the Undi Corps, which numbered about 3,000 to 4,000 in strength.
Guesstimates, aren't they?
They are. It was a mixture of regiments of married men, aged in their 30s and 40s, and a regiment of young unmarried men. Now, they were commanded by Prince Dabalamanzi Kamampande, who was the half brother of King Cetshwayo, and this was because the original designated leader, Inkosi Kamapita, was wounded during the pursuit of British survivors from Islandwana.
Now, they hadn't been active. They hadn't been in the main fight, had they? They'd been the reserve, and they'd swung across the British left flank, and they were there to cut off the British retreat across the Buffalo via Rorke's Drift, and that's why they were appearing in sight. Interestingly enough, how far had they marched? Because they didn't march just the 6.5 miles from Islandwana. They'd marched from where they started that day. How far was that?
That was roughly 20 miles.
Blimey. Now, let's have a look at these. Who are these people? So we've got a mixture of ages, but what are they armed with?
Well, they're mostly armed with the Assegai short spear.
Stabby thing.
Yeah, a few had a bizarre mixture of muskets, antiquated rifles, and also some captured Martini Henrys. Few could hit the proverbial barn door.
Proverbial
barn door, as they were hampered by the poor quality of local.
How can you pronounce the commander of the Zulu's name and not?
Well, I might not have done.
Oh yeah. Oh, you're thinking, I don't know what I'm talking about. Yeah.
Now, they were hampered by the poor quality of locally manufactured powder and bullets. And they also carried shields which were made of cowhide, which provided minimal protection against bullets.
Now, so what was this new commander like? You probably want
what
to
was
say.
His name?
I can't remember. Can you just fill it in for me?
Prince Dabalamanzi.
Oh, yeah, that's him.
He was somewhat impulsive. I think rash would be a better word. And he actually violated King Cetshwayo's orders, which were not to cross the border into Natal.
Now, I found this interesting because, again, it underlines the fact that whatever the overall case the British may have had, and it was weak for triggering this war, it was weak. But he's not... The King of the Zulus was not... Notice how I dodged his name there.
Cetshwayo.
That's it. He's waging a defensive war, isn't he? He has no intention of invading Natal, certainly not at this point. And he does not want to inflame the situation by pushing into British Empire territory. Is he some sort of latter-day pacifist?
No. It's worth mentioning that it's not pacifism. It's sound military and also political common sense.
You don't
the invasion wasn't with the authorisation of the British government.
But you don't poke the British Empire when you don't trigger an avalanche of response, do you?
No.
So, they're in particular, they're not supposed to attack fortified positions. They're not supposed to cross the river. They're not supposed to do any of this. And it's worth noticing that they were definitely not meant to attack what has now become a fort at Rorke's Drift. Why is that? They'd overrun the British lines at Islandwana. Had they overrun them in a frontal attack?
No, I mean, the Impi was effective when the Horns, could infold, which were exactly as they're described. They were the flakes, as it were. They could infold upon flanks and encircle their prey in open ground. And even at Isle Nwana, the Zulus had made absolutely no progress.
The chest, as they called it, hadn't got anywhere, had it?
No, not in frontal attacks. But a fort, even if improvised, doesn't have any open flanks.
So this attack, it's unplanned and unsanctioned. And it's just a raid across the border on Rorke's Drift. He got overexcited, didn't he?
Just a bit.
So what happens then?
Well, the first skirmish occurs at around about 1620, 4:20 p.m., when Lieutenant Henderson's Natal native horse troopers, who are up on Oscarburg...
That's that picket, isn't it?
Yeah, they briefly engaged the Zulus. Now, they'd already had quite a day of it in escaping from Isle Nwana, so they were short of ammunition. And quite frankly...
Tell you, imagine them seeing 4,000 Zulus approaching. What do they do?
Well, quite frankly, they're intimidated by the strength of the Zulu forces approaching. And they abandon Henderson, and they make a run for it, heading to help Makar.
Does Henderson heroically join the garrison then?
Well, he's not much better. He reports to Chard, and then he follows his men.
Very sad. Can I just say that that seems to be a sensible officer? He was on a horse, remember?
Now, their route triggers the departure of Captain Stevenson's native Natal company, who they abandoned the cattle kraal, and they also fled the scene.
Oh, dear. And you're going to be Private Henry Hook, 2nd 24th.
Instantly, the natives, Kaffirs, who had been very useful in making the barricade of wagons, mealy bags and biscuit boxes around the camp, bolted towards Help Makar. And what was worse, their officer and a European sergeant went with them. To see them deserting like that was too much for some of us, and we fired after them. The sergeant was struck and killed.
There do seem to be reports of this, yes. Now, Chard, with this departure, he's got less men. What's the point? What is the problem that this means?
Well, it means he's got to shorten the line defended, and he gives orders to construct a wall of wooden biscuit boxes right through the middle of the post.
Cutting it in half, then?
Yeah, it meant that the hospital side of the station, it could be abandoned if the need arose.
So how many men are there left in Rorke's Drift when the Zulus really arrive? And this is, for us, it's a guess. Other people might work it out to the bloody man, but for us, it's a guesstimate. How many are in Rorke's Drift?
155.
That's not many against 4,000.
No.
You're going to be... one of the first involved for the British is Private Frederick Hitch, 2nd 24th, and you're going to be him.
Lieutenant Bromhead asked me to climb to the top of a building, which I believe had been used as a church, and keep a lookout for the enemy. Having got to the top of the building, I could plainly see the Zulus forming up just over the brow of a hill. "They're ready to attack, sir," I called out to Lieutenant Bromhead, "and I think there are about 4,000 of them." A little fellow named Morris, who heard me, remarked, "Oh, if that's all there are, we can manage that lot all right." Presently, I saw a Zulu, evidently one of their chiefs, who was standing on the summit of a hill, gave the signal by extending his arms, and immediately the whole force commenced to advance on us.
Now, timing's really dodgy about this, and there's definite problems about this. Between 1630 and 1700, the Zulu vanguard, about 600 men, come charging down the Oscarburg Hill, straight towards the south wall of Rorke's Drift. With that link, now that wall links the hospital and the storehouse, doesn't it?
It does. And you're going to be Lieutenant John Chard.
We opened fire on them between 500 and 600 yards. At first, a little wild, but only for a short time. A chief on horseback was dropped by Private Dunbar. The men were quite steady, and the Zulus began to fall very thick. However, it did not seem to stop them at all, although they took advantage of the cover and ran stooping with their faces near the ground. It seemed as if nothing would stop them, and they rushed on, in spite of their heavy loss, to within 50 yards of the wall, when they were taken in flank by the fire from the end wall of the store building, and met with such a heavy direct fire from the mealy wall and the hospital at the same time, that they were checked as if by magic. These are the single-shot Martini Henrys, but if they've given time to reload, they are a deadly and powerful weapon, aren't they? Those bullets just cut through anything. Certainly through cowhide shields.
Meanwhile, the main body of the Zulus, they moved around to attack the north wall. Some of those armed with rifles or muskets, they took up positions on the terraced slopes of Oscarburg Hill, and they began a harassing fire.
Now, that fire doesn't kill many, does it, or wound many? But it does. There's a trickle of casualties from that, isn't there?
Just to complicate things, another body of Zulus attacked the hospital and the northwestern wall. Those British on the barricades, including Dalton and Bromhead, were soon engaged in fierce hand-to-hand fighting. And you're once more going to be Lieutenant John Chard.
A series of desperate assaults were made on the hospital and extending from the hospital as far as the bush reached. But each was most splendidly met and repulsed by our men with a bayonet. Each time as the attack was repulsed by us, the Zulus close to us seemed to vanish in the bush, those some little distance off keeping up a fire all the time. Then, as if moved by a single impulse, they rose up in the bush, as thick as possible, rushing madly up to the wall, some of them being already close to it, seizing where they could the muzzles of our men's rifles or their bayonets and attempting to use their assegais and to get over the wall. A rapid rattle of fire from our rifles, stabs with the bayonets, and in a few moments the Zulus were driven back, disappearing in the bush as before and keeping up their fire. A brief interval and the attack would be again made and repulsed in the same manner. Over and over again this happened. Our fire at the time of these rushes at the Zulus was very rapid. Mr. Dalton dropped a man each time he fired his rifle, while Bromhead and myself used our revolvers. I doubt if they hit anything.
Wow.
Now, I'm interested in this, because what's interesting is, why do they use the bayonets? Why do they have to use their bayonets? And the answer is because the Zulus are so close, there's cover quite close. The hospital isn't... The whole of the thing isn't designed for defence. There's a hill one side and there's rough ground that provides cover and an actual sort of almost low wall. And they can get close. And so how...
Millions of people have lost weight with personalised plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
How many shots can they get off with a single-shot rifle? Not many. And that means that then they have to use the bayonet, don't they?
Because even if they get a shot off, they're not then going to be allowed the luxury of time to reload.
No, this is not enough. Now, so the fighting, how would you describe it?
Well, I'd describe it as you would, I think, as frenetic.
I would have described it as frenetic, that's right.
That's what you did call it.
Corpses mounding up all around a bloody
place.
Yeah,
all in front of the wall. And I'm going to give some quotes from...
You're going to give us a flavour, aren't
Private
you?
Frederick Hitch once more.
So he had been up on the roof, but now he's come down, hasn't he?
They were only turned by the good cold steel of our bayonets, for which they had far more respect than for bullets. Then it was load and fire and bayonet just as fast as we could. They would retire and come on again in rushes, each rush being announced by a short war cry. This war cry, by the way, was very useful to us. We knew what to expect. One Zulu had got through the barricades into the laager. That's just a South African word for a camp.
Yeah.
Was in the act of throwing an assegai at Lieutenant Bromhead, whose attention was directed elsewhere. At that moment, my rifle was unloaded, and there was no time to reload. I shouted to the Zulu and brought my rifle up to my shoulder as if to fire. My Zulu soldier didn't wait. With a duck of the head and a mighty leap, he bounded over the barricades and made off in a manner worthy of an eminent acrobat. One who had missed our bullets came full tilt at me and seized my bayonet with both his hands. This was quite a new experience for me. There was no time to lose. I had to settle up with him quickly or not at all. For a few seconds we struggled for possession of the rifle. Then I managed to point the barrel at his stomach and fired whilst he still clutched the bayonet. He was a brave fellow. I was just about to shoot down a Zulu in front when the Zulu inside shot me through the right shoulder, carrying away the scapula.
I don't know what that is.
Turning round quickly, Bromhead at once shot down the man who had wounded me. I got up again and attempted to use my rifle, but it was no use. My right arm wouldn't work. So I strapped it into my waist belt to keep it out of the way. Then Bromhead gave me his revolver to use, and with this I think I did as much execution as I had done before I was wounded. Seeing how badly wounded I was, one of my comrades, a man named Deacon, asked me whether he should put me out when it came to the finish. He could see that my strength was fast failing, and that if the devils got through, I would be quite unable to strike a blow for myself. "No, I don't think I want any," I said. I had no desire to have my life ended, but it was kind of my friend Deacon to think of me in this way.
I often think of you in that way. I often think, Gary, if you're an extremist, just call on me and I'll put you out of your misery.
Yeah, that would be a kindness, Pete.
It certainly would. Now, so what's Chard thinking? I, as Chard, are thinking that the North Wall couldn't be held against the main strength of Zulu. So at about 1800, so that's about an hour and a half. We don't really know, do we? He pulled his men back into the yard, abandoning the hospital in the process. So now that he's pulled them back. What happens to the people in the hospital? Surely the wounded that you can't move are in there. Sure. So what is happening in the hospital?
Well, it's becoming a death trap as the loopholes have become somewhat of a liability. If they try to fire from them, then their Martini Henrys were grabbed at by the Zulus.
And but once you've fired, you can't fire again until you get the Martini Henry back, yeah.
But if left empty, the Zulus used the loopholes themselves to fire into the rooms. Now, Privates Horrigan, John Williams, Joseph Williams and other patients tried to hold the hospital entrance with rifles and fixed bayonets. Joseph Williams defended a small window and 14 dead Zulus were later counted beneath his window.
It's strange how these names are all known, aren't they? They really did try and plot what's happened. I don't always understand it myself, but funnily enough, the next phase we're going to talk about, if you want to get the flavour of it, I think you'd advise watching the film.
The film does get this quite accurately, I think.
So what happened? So the front of the hospital, that's overrun by Zulus, isn't it? So the British are confined to the back of the hospital. And what does Private John Williams do? I think this is just amazing.
Well, he uses a pickaxe to hack a hole through the wall dividing the central room and a corner room in the back of the hospital. Now, this is what I mean about watching the film. You can see he does it with a bayonet, I think, in the film. But you can see what they're doing by creating holes through the walls. And Chard, he had his own perspective.
Yeah, I bet he did. Well, I like this. All this time, the enemy had been attempting to fire the hospital and had at length set fire to its roof and got in at the far end. I had tried to impress upon the men in the hospital the necessity for making a communication right through the building. Unfortunately, this was not done. I like that. What does a British soldier not like? Hard work. At times. Probably at the time, the men could not see the necessity, and doubtless also there was no time to do it. Without in the least detracting from the gallant fellows who defended the hospital, I hope I shall not be misunderstood in saying so. So in other words, he's saying, I told them to get a hole through those bleeding walls, and they didn't do it, the bastards.
Now, it may have been belated, but John Williams chopped his own passage. Just the,
a back passage, so to speak.
Just as he had made a big enough hole to get through, the Zulus renewed their attack on the door of the central room. And even so, Williams managed to drag two bedridden patients out before the door gave way.
Ah, this is real heroism, isn't it? Now, so he drags the two invalids into a corner room. Now, who's in that corner room? And this is where the film goes badly wrong in some senses. Who's in there?
Well, it was occupied by Private Hook and nine other patients. And I'm going
to
be...
So Hook, he's a patient as well, isn't he?
Yeah, and I'm going to be Private Henry Hook. It was impossible to do anything except fight, and I blazed away as hard as I could. By this time, I was the only defender of my room. Poor old Cole was lying dead outside, and the helpless patient was crying and groaning near me. The Zulus were swarming around us, and there was an extraordinary rattle as the bullets struck the biscuit boxes, and queer thuds as they plumped into the bags of mealies. Then there were the whiz and rip of the assegais. We had plenty of ammunition, but we were told to save it, and so we took careful aim at every shot, and hardly a cartridge was wasted.
Now, we didn't mention Cole, but Cole had lost his nerve and run out and been butchered, as you'd expect. Now, they're still trapped, so what does John Williams do? He's good at this.
Well, he then hacks at the wall to the next room with his pickaxe, and whilst he's doing this, Hook is actually holding off the Zulus.
So tell us more.
What were we to do? We were pinned like rats in a hole. Already the Zulus were fiercely trying to burst in through the doorway. The only way of escape was the wall itself, by making a big hole big enough for a man to crawl through into an adjoining room, and so on until we got to our inmost entrenchment outside. Williams worked desperately at the wall with the navvy's pick, which I had been using to make some of the loopholes.
Oh, that's where it came from.
All this time the Zulus were trying to get into the room. Their assegais kept whizzing towards us, and one struck me in front of the helmet. But the helmet tilted back under the blow and made the spear lose its power, so that I escaped with a scalp wound, which did not trouble me much. Only one man at a time could get in at the door. A big Zulu sprang forward and seized my rifle, but I tore it free and, slipping a cartridge in, I shot him point blank. Time after time, the Zulus gripped the muzzle and tried to tear the rifle from my grasp. And time after time, I wrenched it back because I had a better grip than they had. All this time, Williams was getting the sick through the hole into the next room. All except one, a soldier of the 24th named Conley, who could not move because of a broken leg. Watching for my chance, I dashed from the doorway and, grabbing Conley, I pulled him after me through the hole. His leg got broken again, but there was no help for it. As we left the room, the Zulus burst in with furious cries of disappointment and rage.
Now, we want to make clear, I mean, Hook's a real hero in this, and he's not a drunk, as nope. was portrayed, I think, and that's definite. So we'll just put that in. That's just it's a plot thing in the film, isn't it? It's not anything real.
Well, the film is entertainment.
Yes. Now, yes, and it is entertaining. Now, so Private John Williams set to smashing another hole. They should call him Digger Williams, shouldn't they? And what else is speeding him up a bit?
Well, he's being somewhat encouraged by the realisation that the roof's now on fire. Once again, Hook's defended the hole behind them while Private Waters fired through a loophole.
Now, it just takes some time, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, this was surprising. After 50 minutes, the hole was passable. The patients were dragged through, and they were now in the last room of the hospital. Two of the garrison were already there, Private Robert Jones and Private William Jones.
And people often say that the 2nd 24th are really the Warwickshires, but they're not a Welsh regiment, but a lot of them are Welsh, hence the unimaginative and the extreme naming.
Yes, and you're going to be Private William Jones of the 2nd 24th.
What with the bloodthirsty yells of the Zulus, the cries of the sick that remained, and the burning thatch falling about our heads, it was sickening. Still, we kept them at bay until 20 out of the 23 sick men were passed into the barricade under the fire of our own men. The other three, which I have every reason to believe must have wandered back into one of the rooms we had cleared, they were men suffering from fever at the time. By this time, the whole of the hospital was in flames, and we could not stay in it any longer. We had to make our own escape. Somewhat Victorian sentence construction, some of these quotes. What he means is that they made the dash from this last room across to the barricade where the main force were. That's a piece of open ground. That's a dangerous time, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's desperate, in fact. And you're going to be Private Robert Jones, not my brother or sister, also 2nd 24th.
I had 3 assegai wounds, 2 in the right side and 1 in the left of my body. We did not know of anyone being in the hospital, only the Zulus. And then after a long time of fighting at the door, we made them retire. And then we made our escape out of the building. Just as I got outside, the roof fell in, a complete mass of flames and fire. I had to cross a space of about 20 or 30 yards from the ruins of the hospital to the leaguered company, where they were keeping the enemy at bay. While I was crossing the front of the square, the bullets were whishing past me from every direction.
So those last desperate minutes, the patients and the soldiers are just climbing out the windows and running back across this open thing.
Yeah, now behind them, Private Waters and Beckett, they hid in the wardrobe.
This is a surrealistic part of the story, and I'm going to be Lieutenant John Chard, who describes what happened. And we haven't got the account of the person concerned, so we'll have to use the second person. Chard says, Private Waters, 24th Regiment, told me that he had secreted himself in a cupboard in the room he was defending, and from it shot several Zulus inside the hospital. He was wounded in the arm, and he remained in the cupboard until the heat and smoke were so great that they threatened to suffocate him. Wrapping himself in a cloak or a skirt or a dress he found in the cupboard, he rushed out into the darkness and made his way into the cookhouse. The Zulus were occupying this and firing at us from the wall nearest us. It was too late to retreat, so he crept slowly to the fireplace and, standing up in the chimney, blacked his face and hands with the soot. He remained there until the Zulus left. He was very nearly shot in coming out. One of our men at the face raising his rifle to do so at the sight of his black face and strange costume. But Walters cried out just in time to save himself. Now that is what, as an oral historian, I say is an extremely dodgy story. Do you believe it? I don't know.
I believe that he may have dressed up in a skirt.
Yeah, you're thinking. Yeah. I mean, to be honest, when you're looking at these things, did Chard believe it? And Chard seems to have believed it. I don't know if the exact details are true. But what it... I mean, the excitement of the story. So some of the bits don't hang together.
But, no.
But it was chaotic. And perhaps the Zulus were distracted and he snuck out then. All this sort of thing.
Now, his colleague, Private Beckett, he was badly wounded with assegais while running through the Zulus. He managed to get away and hide himself in the garden ditch. Next day, he was found, but he'd almost bled out and he died shortly afterwards.
So he nearly made it. That's a shame. So of the 11 patients, 9 survived the crossing to the barricade, and all the able-bodied men made it. Only 4 defenders were killed in the hospital, and this is the scale of casualties. It's very low, isn't it? One was a member of the Natal native contingent. He was helpless. He had a broken leg. Sergeant Maxfield and Private Jenkins, well, they had an awful fate, and I'm going to tell that story, should I? Yeah, there's Lieutenant John Child again. Sergeant Maxfield might have been saved, but he was delirious with fever, refused to move and resisted the attempts to move him. He was assegaied before our men's eyes, and that was referenced in one of the other quotes that some of them didn't know what they were doing.
Private Cole, assigned to the hospital alongside Private Hook, he was killed when he ran outside.
Yeah, I mentioned that, yeah. That.
Another hospital patient killed was Trooper Hunter. And once more, you're going to continue the story as Lieutenant John Chard.
Trooper Hunter, Natal Mounted Police, escaping from the hospital, stood still for a moment, hesitating which way to go, dazed by the glare of the burning hospital and the firing that was going on all around. He was assegaied before our eyes. The Zulu who killed him immediately afterwards falling, so they got their vengeance. But the poor son, you can imagine, bursting out, disorientated, and just not knowing what to do. And in those seconds, he's just chopped down.
Now, the evacuation of the burning hospital, that completes the shortening of the perimeter. And Lieutenant John Chard goes on to say,
while firing from behind the biscuit boxes, Dalton, who had been using his rifle with deadly effect, and by his quickness and coolness had been the means of saving many men's lives, was shot through the body. I was standing near him at the time, and he handed me his rifle so coolly that I had no idea until afterwards of how severely he was wounded. He waited quite quietly for me to take the cartridges he had left out of his pocket. Wow. Mm. That Dalton is a real hero. But I like, don't you like the fact that they're not trying to make themselves, they're not bigging themselves up. That all these officers are paying tribute to each other's work. I like that. It's quite rare in these circumstances.
Now, as night falls, the Zulu attacks continue, and Hook, he'd joined the defenders on the walls.
His day wasn't over that night.
No, and I'm going to once more be Private Henry Hook. By this time, it was dark and the hospital was all in flames. But this gave us a splendid light to fight by. I believe it was this light that saved us. We could see them coming, and they could not rush us and take us by surprise from any point. They could not get us, and so they went away and had 10 or 15 minutes of a war dance. This roused them up again, and their excitement was so intense that the ground fairly seemed to shake. Then, when they were goaded to the highest pitch, they would hurl themselves at us again.
Now, the cattle car, that had been evacuated before 2200. That had gone. And the defenders are now... where are they? They're just round the storehouse, really, aren't they? They're backs to the wall sort of thing. And I'm going to be Lieutenant John Chard. The enemy were now in strong force all round us. And every now and then, a confused shout of, "Ushufu!" from many voices seemed to show that we were going to be that they were going to attack from one side. And immediately the same thing would happen on the other, leaving us in doubt as to where they meant to attack. About midnight or a little after, the fire slackened. And after that, although they kept us constantly on the alert by feigning, as before, to come on at different points, the fire was of a desultory character. Our men were careful and only fired when they could see a fair chance, he means of hitting the target. The flames of the burning hospital were now getting low, and as pieces of the roof fell or hitherto unburnt parts of the thatch ignited, the flames would blaze up, illuminating our helmets and faces. A few shots from the Zulus replied to by our men. Again, silence, broken only by the same things repeatedly happening. Throughout the night, the Zulus kept up a constant assault against the British positions. That's just amazing. The whole thing. They do start to slacken, though, don't they? As Chard mentions that, after about midnight, they slacken. And when would you say they almost stop?
Well, they finish at about 2 o'clock in the morning. But nevertheless, the garrison's still under a desultory harassing fire until about 4 in the morning.
Now, I'm stunned by the casualties. Just go through them for me and stun me again.
Well, by that time, the garrison had sustained 14 dead. 2 more were mortally wounded.
Well, they're dead as well, yeah.
8 more were seriously wounded. Nearly all the defending garrison had some minor wounds, often more cuts than wounds.
Yeah, that'd be the assegai cut. So yeah. They'd be. I mean, me and you would probably demand immediate hospital treatment, but in the circumstances...
Although relatively light, they were all totally exhausted after their 10-hour battle. Wow. Under the most severe stress imaginable. So it's not just the wounds.
It's just total exhaustion, yeah. Now, they were lucky with ammunition, weren't they? But
well, they were beginning to run low. Of 20,000 rounds in reserve at the mission, only 900 remained.
Now, dawn breaks, and the garrison could see that the Zulus are gone. There's nobody in sight, just the dead and the wounded Zulus all around them. And they actually send patrols out to just have a look round, recover rifles, look for survivors. What would they do to the Zulu wounded?
Well, many of them, they would kill as soon as they find them.
And there's graphic details I'm going to give here from Lieutenant John Chard. He says this: some of the bullet wounds were very curious. One man's head was split open, exactly as if done with an axe. Another had been hit just between the eyes, a bullet carrying away the whole of the back of his head, leaving his face perfect, as though it were a mask, only disfigured by the small hole made by the bullet passing through. This is the usual things about small entrance, big exit wounds. Then you think it's all over, and this is amusingly done in the film. Then they think it's all over. They think it's all over. It's not, is it?
No.
There's a terrible alarm, and I'm going to be charred again. At about 7 a.m., a large body of the enemy, I believe the same who had attacked us, they were, appeared on the hills to the southwest. I thought at the time they were going to attack us, but from what I now know from the Zulus and also of the number we put to Horde Comba, I do not think so. I think they came up on the high ground to observe Lord Chelmsford advance. From there, they could see the column long before it came in sight for us, and that's apparently what happened.
Yeah.
Who else would be tired other than the British defenders?
Well, the Zulus, they're also exhausted. You know, let's not forget they'd been on the march for the best part of 6 days.
They'd done 20 miles up the day of the attack. First.
Yeah, and they had little or no food.
They'd been up all night.
So they retired from the battlefield. Now, around 8 o'clock, there's another alarm.
Oh, this one's all right, though.
Yeah, this time it was Lord Chelmsford Column, which had marched back from Islandwana.
Because they'd not been at Islandwana, they'd been wandering about the hills, and they'd come back through... come back through Islandwana, seen the thing, and then made their way back to Rorke's Drift.
So it's all over now.
Oh, is it all over by the shouting, do you
think? It's all over, and you're going to be once more Lieutenant John Chard.
I like this quote. In wrecking the stores in my wagon, the Zulus had brought to light a forgotten bottle of beer. A Bromhead, and I drank it, with mutual congratulations on having come safely out of so much danger. I love the idea that, oh, I say there's a bottle of beer there. Fancy a drop, Bromhead.
After the battle, Chard reported some 351 Zulu corpses.
That's not right, though, is it?
No, because others were later found on the side of the Oscarberg Hill. And it's been estimated that at least 500 wounded and captured Zulus might have been massacred as well.
Now, one can understand why people at the time did that, but this is a terrible business, and it's the dark side of the British Empire.
Well, after seeing the results at Islandwana, Chelmsford's relief force, they had no mercy, and nor did the Rorke's Drift defenders, frankly.
No. And you're going to be Trooper William Clark of the Natal Mounted Police.
Altogether, we buried 375 Zulus, and some wounded were thrown into the grave. Seeing the manner in which our wounded had been mutilated after being dragged from the hospital, we were very bitter and did not spare wounded Zulus.
And there's a short quote from Lieutenant, your hero, Lieutenant Horace Smith-Doran. He'd been a member of Chelmsford's staff, and he'd managed to get away, one of the very lucky ones. And he wrote, the day after the battle, they set up an improvised gallows. What did he say?
Oh, well, he said it was for hanging Zulus who were supposed to have behaved treacherously.
Now, 11 Victoria Crosses awarded to the defenders of Rorke's Drift. and that's the most ever received for a single action by one regiment, because 7 of them were awarded to the 2nd 24th Foot. Sorry, I'm carried away by the emotion of it all.
But in addition to that, there were 4 Distinguished Conduct Medals also awarded.
Now, some have been cynical about this and said that the medals were awarded to deflect attention. Look over here, look over here. Don't look at Isenwana, look at Rorke's Drift. But I'm not sure about this. Who were they awarded to? Let's have a look at them. Well, I'll be first, because one of them's to me in my character of Lieutenant John Chard of the 5th Field Company Royal Engineers. But who got it from B Company 2nd 24th Foot? Just name them for us.
So the VCs awarded were to Lieutenant Gonville Bromhead, Corporal William Allen, Private Frederick Hitch, although... There is a later issue because he loses or has it stolen whilst in hospital, although there's a suggestion he actually sold it and he had to pay for a replacement. Private Alfred Henry Hook, Private Robert Jones, Private William Jones and Private John Williams, all of whom featured quite strongly in the podcast.
They did. Well, we picked them specially. The Army Medical Department, well, Surgeon Major James Henry Reynolds gets it. And then I think almost everybody's favourite. Who's that?
Well, the Commissariat and Transport Department's Acting Assistant Commissary, James Langley Dalton.
And then the 2nd, 3rd Natal Native Contingent. We missed out his story. That's a shame, but we can't do everything. Who's that?
That's Corporal Christian Ferdinand Scheiss.
Now, the cynicism about the Rorke's Drift can be quite unpleasant, and it's summed up by you acting as Sir Garnet Wolsey. He takes over the Commander-in-Chief post from Lord Chelmsford, although Chelmsford actually wins the Zulu War, but then he's replaced by Wolsey. Now, Wolsey is unimpressed by the VCs. What did you... And I'm glad you've chosen to be him, because a lot of Wolsey's... sort of character is reflected in your own.
Oh, you mean so when we went through the notes and decided you'd do it, we were deciding not to have that?
Yes. I don't want to
so
be.
So I'm going to be General Sir Garnet Wolseley. It is monstrous making heroes of those who, shut up in buildings at Rorke's Drift, could not bolt and fought like rats for their lives, which they could not otherwise save.
Now that's... Gary, how can you say that? That I was meant to say.
Well,
I think it's appalling. And but let's talk. What do we think? What do we think, Gary?
Well, thanks to Dalton largely and hard work, the improvised defences were strong enough to hold.
Now, the other thing, I mean, these are just points when you're assessing what happened. The defenders were well armed with rifles, and they had enough ammunition. Only just, but the Zulus, they had some guns, but ineffectually used, weren't they? Also, another part. These are points in favour of what Wolsey says, I suppose. Were the casualties?
Well, for a 12-hour fight, they're relatively light, aren't they? But
so those points, improvised defences were thanks to Dalton, but the improvised defences were good enough. There's no flanks to take. The defenders are better armed than the assailants, and the casualties were light. So why all these VCs? Yeah, let's put some other points.
Yeah, but I think you also have got to say that in attacking a fortified position, the Zulus had effectively given away any advantage they had by flanking movements. They played into the hands of the defenders.
So that's another point. But why should they get the visit? What is remarkable?
Despite that, the massed attacks by the Zulus would have been absolutely terrifying.
I can't get beyond this because it must have been. I mean, I can understand why Cole lost his nerve and ran out.
Absolutely.
I think that's the sort of thing we might have done, Gareth.
3,000 or 4,000.
And you can talk about military logic all you like about defences and about better weapons, but Jesus, this is appalling. The other thing is, they had better weapons, but did they have a clear field of fire that allowed them to fire so many rounds a minute?
No, I mean, Martina Henry's an excellent rifle.
It is.
Single shot.
Brilliant. Weapon. It's single shot. We've mentioned it. So they can get close.
Yeah. So during the reloading, the Zulus can get closer. They knew what had happened at Isla Nuala.
Yeah. So this is another point. I mean, people who've been at Isla Nuala couldn't stand up to it. They basically ran, didn't they? It's only the people who hadn't who stood.
And that was a much bigger force, don't forget.
Yeah. The defending force certainly was. The other thing is, people say as if the defenders of Rorke's Drift knew they'd be relieved. Did they know they'd be relieved by the arrival of Chelmsford?
No, I mean, there was a suggestion earlier, wasn't there, that Chelmsford had suffered the same fate as the troops at Isla Nuala, so they may never have been relieved.
There's another thing. What was that about ammunition? What might have happened if Chelmsford hadn't arrived when he did?
Well, 900 rounds, was it?
They might have run out of ammunition.
Well, they would have run out of ammunition.
Yeah. So so what do we think in the end? I think that there are arguments on that bastard, Wolsey, ably played, very, very in character by yourself. So there is a point.
Yeah.
But we think it's overwhelmed. We think, on the whole, there's some smoke and mirrors about what's going on, about why they do it. Because the British Army doesn't always give VCs according to how courageous a fight is, does it?
No, I mean, it was a very generous award of decorations, but actually the men were heroes. As were the Zulus, you know, let's not forget this, whose names we'll never know.
I think that's a good point to finish on, that we will never know what those... They were just as courageous, weren't they?
Yeah.
And, it's an amazing... It's a skirmish, really. It's not a battle. Isla Nuala was a battle, and we lost that. The British won at Rorke's Drift, but... It was a terrible, terrible scene afterwards. It must have been. I can't imagine what it looked like afterwards. All the bodies everywhere.
There are actually some pictures on the internet if you want to go and have a look at once Chelmsford's force had arrived.
I'll do that. Well, Gary, thanks for joining me in this. And it's a bit of a year since our last visit to Isla Nuala. This is our It's and One a Day, Rock's Drift Day.
It's early.
It's early.
Cheers, mate.
Cheers.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. Their meditations range to fit your needs each day, from anxiety and stress, relaxation and focus, to building habits and taking care of your physical well-being. They even have expert-led talks on topics such as tips for overcoming stress and anxiety, handling grief, improving self-esteem, caring for relationships, and more. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president. You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?